we've been operating in solidarity with the people of El Salvador since in the middle of the guerrilla war that was taking place in El Salvador throughout the 80s and post-peace accords that happened in 92. We have a national office in D.C. and a bunch of chapters around such as Seattle and Olympia, Portland, Bay Area, L.A., Boston, New York, D.C. soon to come, and many more. Perhaps even in Austin. Who knows? But we are all just down in El Salvador to witness the triumph of the FMLN government, which is the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Army turned political party, win for the first time the presidential spot in El Salvador, making it the first political force in El Salvador.
The first political force?
Yeah, the first political force. Because you don't really count the Arena government when they were like up death squads and reinstated by the U.S. and winning off of like false...
That's the right-wing party?
That's the right-wing party, yeah.
How long were they in power before?
They've been in power, well, since the peace accords officially as a political party and before the peace accords for 5 years before that. And we're ruling by intimidation through death squads and assassinations, disappearances, and military. We're ruling through military dictatorships before that. So they've been in power for a long ass time.
With that, are you done?
Mm-hmm, yeah, sure, whatever.
Well, I was hoping you could talk more about what CISPIS does specifically.
Specifically.
Or maybe what Olympia has going on.
Okay. Well, specifically, CISPIS works on a solidarity model nationally, where we have institutional relationships with people in El Salvador through our San Salvador representative office. We have been maintaining relationships with parts of the FMLN, such as the Women's Secretariat, student groups, a whole slew of different unions. And we've been accompanying Salvadorans since 1980 on delegations to go down to witness what's happening in El Salvador, to hear firsthand from the people of El Salvador what the need is and how we could be effective organizing in the United States, and then we in turn come back and we try to raise consciousness of the United States citizens and others to act and to take action against our government, against the foreign policy of our government. To possibly change the foreign policy, we do some lobbying and congressional stuff, which is the less glorified part of our work, kind of boring, but it still needs to happen. So that's nationally. Olympia CISPIS has been in operation for a number of years. Larry Mosqueda has been a huge part of keeping that alive, along with a handful of other people. So props to Larry for that. Currently, we've been mainly based at Evergreen as a student activities group, which has its pluses and minuses, trying to organize a student body, for better or for worse. But generally, we try to raise the awareness of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, particularly in El Salvador, and to foster the relationship building between Olympia and El Salvador as well. And right now, we're currently kind of in a transition stage where we are going to be on the ground floor with a handful of other people starting a Latin American Solidarity Center, so you should keep your eyes and ears and other senses open for that coming soon. Olympia CISPIS, we were a handful of ragtag kids who were, down with El Salvador, not down with imperialism or capitalism. Yes, so I guess briefly, that's what we do.
Great, bunny face. Here's some things I was thinking of while you're talking. How come, and maybe this is too personal, how come you chose to get involved in CISPIS and how, and then maybe also you could talk about why, I guess these are the same question, but why it's important to do solidarity work with Latin American countries?
Well, I was first introduced to CISPIS in the winter of 2005. It was just months after I had moved my ass up from the suburbs of Chicago. And I began getting involved with a community organization known as the Olympia Movement for Justice and Peace, where I met a couple individuals who were really about Latin American solidarity and encouraged me to come to a few meetings of CISPIS. And so I did. And upon meeting the people that were running CISPIS at that time, one of which was Larry Mosqueda, another one was Elizabeth Velasquez, who now lives in D.C. and is working on our national office, I realized that the people that were in this organization, you know, at least in Olympia, seemed really enthused about what they were doing. They were about to go to El Salvador that following March in 2006 to do elections observing, and I was encouraged to come along. And not having known, I mean, next to nothing about El Salvador, I was first just brought in by the enthusiasm of the people who were in the group, but then realizing what had been happening in El Salvador throughout the 80s when I was a kid growing up, you know, and then being completely ignorant to what was happening growing up, and learning as I was, like, raising my consciousness about what was happening at the behest of our government, it was amazing to hear that there was this organization that has this history, and it was amazing to hear that there's these people in El Salvador who have been organizing, you know, in spite of the massive repression that happens at the butt of a gun and by threatening of livelihoods and just the amazing organizing that had been happening. So after I had gone down to El Salvador and witnessed this firsthand, had met a few people who live down there, had seen a handful of people who have been organizing with this organization for years, I mean, since I was like a wee little babe, and it was really inspiring. It was amazing because this is like I was just getting into organizing, I was just becoming politically active, and to see an organization that has such a history that operates on a solidarity model that I feel is really effective since the organization has been around for almost 30 years. You know, there's got to be something that has to speak to something. And then also and experiencing while being in El Salvador, while people identify CISPIS as being a part of the organizing and the continued revolution happening in El Salvador, which is great to be a part of it. It's a great feeling. So that's how I got turned on to it. And the reason I stick around is because the organizing model of CISPIS, I believe, is one that is very strong, that has stood the test of time, that has, but is not, you know, stagnant or rigid by any means, that it's constantly changing with every convention and every administrative conference, it's just been really amazing to be a part of the organization and to be brought in and to have my skill set increased as an organizer because I'm just surrounding myself with people who are really interested in anti-capitalist organizing, really down to the struggle in El Salvador and Latin America in general, which I guess I could begin to approach your second question, but why Latin American, and particularly why El Salvador is so important to me at least, is El Salvador has been the testing ground for a lot of things that the U.S. has been exporting throughout the rest of the world. For example, the death squad model that the U.S. Drafted, created in the School of the Americas by the founder of the Arena Party named Dabusson, who was trained in the School of the Americas and was the head of the death squads in El Salvador throughout the 80s. This model was perfected and then exported to Iraq after the 2003 invasion, and has been used in other places as a means of terrorizing any sort of organizing that's happening, terrorizing people into submission, disappearing organizers, disappearing union leaders. These are things that, you know, that have pretty much had, like, that are like the fingerprint of the United States, like military thing. And so that's one example of how that happens in El Salvador, gets exported around the world. But more importantly, the struggle in Latin America is one that has been going on for 500 plus years, and since colonialism. And it's really been amazing to learn and to experience. People who are so motivated and so inspired and have such militancy and have such and are so vigilant about what they're doing And to see this neocolonialism basically falling apart at the seams. And what's been going on in Latin America, I feel, is always what's happening, is about to happen in the United States in the next couple of years. Military repression, militarization of police forces, we're seeing it here. So I mean, and not only we share a continent with these people, and I just feel Latin America is super duper important.
Super duper important.
Super duper important.
So when you got involved because it, or part of the appeal was that it was such an established, successful, more or less, group.
Yeah.
And had been around for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Do you, Bunny Face, see any problems that might occur from a group being that old? You said that it stood the test of time or whatever.
Yeah.
But maybe there's some... Have you seen any negative impacts from a group being around that long? Any critiques?
I definitely have critiques, but I would say I have more critiques about... excuse me. I would say my critiques are more about... the way we handle when we're changing. Like right now we're on a huge point in our organizational history where we started accompanying the guerrilla war, during the guerrilla war, bringing people down to witness what was happening, and then we changed in 92 to the peace accords and had to change our model from being in solidarity with people resisting a war to being in solidarity with people who are forming the base to get this political party in power. And now we're changing now in a new step of this revolution where now what are we going to be in solidarity with a political party? Are we going to be in solidarity with the state government? It's a really interesting question. But as far as CISPUS and its model, I think the years that have, being in an older group, I guess I wouldn't see it because I have come in like only the last 3 years of necessarily seeing like a lot of critiques to bring out, because our organizational structure is one that is like rooted in, solidarity work is rooted in anti-oppression work, and so we're constantly, that's like the focus of it. So we're constantly trying to reinvent ourselves and change and become a better organizing model. So that's my experience with it. But I guess the critique of being an older organization, I would say, is I guess there is less agility, maybe is the word. I don't know if that's the correct word. I guess we do change, but it's much slower than maybe some organizations would like. I could see people coming into our organization, CISPUS, and being like, this is too rigid. I can't come in and like switch things up. So, and I think that I've seen people come and go for those reasons. However, I don't necessarily see that as a debilitating critique. And then the second part of that question you were asking.
I don't know if there was two parts to it, Bunny.
yeah, so I guess, I don't know. As far as I'm concerned, the age of the group only lends to the experience and to the richness of the relationship. So maybe, whatever, obviously I'm going to be a little impartial, but I don't...
Biased?
Biased. Impartial. Yeah, the opposite of what I said. That's what I meant to say.
Maybe you can explain... Like, is CISPUS, up until now, main focus has been supporting FMLN?
Yeah.
And then, what are other relationships, like what other kind of groups that are maybe like more, are less established, more like grassrootsy that CISPUS has?
Well, our relationship with the party is one that is based historically, because when the FMLN was formed, it was very close to when CISPUS was formed, and some have said that CISPUS is just the sixth arm of the FMLN working in the United States, because it was founded by Salvadorans who had fled El Salvador. Who had fled El Salvador in the 80s, before the 80s, in the 1980s. So, It was originally Salvadorans in the United States, and so it's been called the Sixth Arm of the FMLN. However, you know, during the war, what we did was we brought people down to witness what was happening. So yeah, it was definitely solidarity with the guerrilla combatants, the FMLN, and people who were suffering from the military bombing and the, you know, support of the military. Since the Peace Accords, and during before that even, we did develop relationships with a handful of organizations, one known as the Equipo Maíz, which is a popular education group. We have relationships with almost every, I mean, I don't want to say every, but a vast majority of the unions operating in El Salvador. I mean, from the teachers' unions to electric workers' unions to water worker unions to telecommunication worker unions to the informal sector unions to unions trying to form in maquilas. We have relationship with multiple student groups. We have relationship with an independent youth radio collective. We have relationships with the only relationship that actually we have institutionally. I mean, other than just the history of being part of the FMLN and being embraced by the party and, you know, very warmly welcomed when we go down there, is really the women's secretary to the FMLN, which is not, I mean, it's part of the party, but its sole purpose of being formed was to change the party, to stop being this machismo, male-run organization. But this particular part of the FMLN is to foster, founded by women combatants, to foster leadership development within other women to take on the party, to take more leadership within the party. So that's really our only party relationship. And our docket, is all since I've been involved, is included our material aid docket for every year, changes every year. The women's secretariat has been a consistent. The SETA, which is the water workers union, has been consistent because they've been fighting water privatization for a handful of years now. And then since I've been around, we've had the FUR. If any of you were around in 2007, Oswaldo Natarén came to El Guanaco, and we had Obeyes de Bajo Mundo, and we had a little party. I don't know if any of you remember that. He was from the FUR, which is the Frente Universitario de Roque Dalton.
Maybe you should take it out.
And also, let me think, our newest institutional relationship, I think, is... What is our newest one? Oh, it's with the Town of Mexicanos Youth Casa de Juventud, which is a youth home, a youth space for a handful of different activities, cultural activities and what have you. So, I mean, we have a broad relationship with grassroots organizations and with the social movement. I mean, it's huge. Definitely not just party.
Cool, bunny face. I think maybe we'll take a little brief break and come back and have some more Q&A. Maybe you want to go on the internet there and pick out some... The internet is that Firefox. Oh. Insignia. And I'll just take this opportunity to remind you what you're doing, which is listening to Free Radio Olympia 98.5. The third ranking pirate radio station in Olympia. The number in the studio if you want to participate instead of playing in the sun and you want to talk on the phone in your house. The number is 705-9780. Also, here's another thing that I'll say while Bunnyface sets up the music. Is that next week on Thursday, there is a Free Radio Olympia show, benefit that is, at La Voyer, featuring relatively new kind of Olympia bands. It's All Gotta Go, The Maybes, Socks and Sandals, and The Warning Track. So do that, and we're going to listen to a band from El Salvador. Hit it!
Como el nuestro
merece la victoria, no le fallaremos.
A ver, compadientes, compadre.
gusta Ecuador.
No.
Me deleitan los colores que tiene mi bandera flameante bajo el sol. Me deleitan los colores que tiene mi bandera flameante bajo el sol. Por los cerros, vaguadas y volcanes se oye el canto ancestral de Torogón. Sus cantares impulsan mis afanes, mi divisa es ver libre a mi nación. Sus cantares impulsan mis afanes, mi divisa es ver libre a mi nación. Mi descanso es cumplir con mi tarea, mi alegría es cumplir con mi deber. Para que el mundo más humano sea, hemos jurado luchar hasta vencer. Para que el mundo más humano sea, hemos jurado luchar hasta vencer. Mi familia es todo el pueblo pobre, mi madrecita es la revolución. Mi familia es todo el pueblo pobre, mi madrecita es la revolución. Por los cerros, vaguadas y volcanes se oye el canto ancestral de Torogón. Sus cantares impulsan mis afanes, mi divisa es ver libre a mi nación. Sus cantares impulsan mis afanes, mi divisa es ver libre a mi nación. Mi descanso es cumplir con mi tarea, mi deber. Para que el mundo más humano sea, hemos jurado luchar hasta vencer. Para que el mundo más humano sea, hemos jurado luchar hasta vencer.
A los señores que están en el gobierno, a quienes han secuestrado.
Oye, compadre.
Ajá, compadre.
Pasa la consigna. Hay que darle mecha a la dictadura.
Hay que darle mecha a la dictadura.
Hay que darle mecha a la dictadura.
Popular. Las batallas decisivas se avecinan, hay que integrarse a la milicia clandestina. Milicianos preparan donde están ya, para avanzar junto a la fuerza regular, y todo el pueblo se debe de incorporar, porque se acerca nuestro triunfo popular.
Presidente electo. Vamos pobladores
a colaborar.
Balas y machetes
hay que preparar.
Hombres y mujeres, todos a luchar.
A participar en la lucha popular.
Hombres y mujeres, todos a luchar.
A participar en la lucha popular.
Digamos muchacho en mi corporación.
Necesitando la revolución.
Digamos muchacho en mi corporación.
Necesitando la revolución.
Nuestros enemigos, los fusiles y las armas populares, derrotaremos a todos los asesinos, y con el triunfo de nuestra revolución, vamos logrando la ansiada liberación, puño con puño a defender nuestra nación. Somos pobladores,
a colaborar,
balas y machetes,
hay que preparar,
hombres y mujeres, todos a luchar,
a participar en la lucha popular.
Vamos pobladores,
a colaborar,
balas y machetes,
hay que preparar,
niños y ancianos, todos a luchar,
a participar en la lucha popular.
Sigamos muchachos en la incorporación,
solicitando la revolución.
Sigamos muchachos en la incorporación,
solicitando la revolución.
Okay, who was that?
That was Los Torregoses de Morazan.
I think you should take it out of, yeah, there you go. So, we're here still talking.
You're really loud.
I'm really loud. To Bunny Face, and he's talking about Cispis, and what were you just talking about before we left?
El Salvador. But you had asked if Cispis...
Oh, the other groups besides FMLN. Yeah. And the answer was yes.
Yeah, I mean.
There are other groups besides the FMLN in El Salvador. One thing that Cispis does is bringing people, as in Americans, down there to do witnesses. Now I'm low. Witnessing? Is that what you said? Or am I making that up?
In the 80s, that was something they did for people, U.S. citizens, to witness what was happening at the hands of their tax dollars in U.S. military training. Now it's not so much like witnessing, but bringing people down to experience and to meet and to, basically to meet and witness what's happening with the social movement in El Salvador. Yeah. So, yes. Short answer, yes.
But before it was witnessing what?
The war,
elections?
before it was witnessing the war. Now it's witnessing lots of different things. This is my third delegation I just got back from. This is the second elections observing delegation that I've been on. The other one that I went on that wasn't elections observing was a May Day delegation, where we went down and met with a lot of the same organizations and met with a lot of the same people and heard, you know, what has been going on in the country since CAFTA was passed, what has been going on. One focus of that was also to, you know, I mean, because one thing that we do when we're down there is we try to use our privilege of having a U.S. passport and meet with the embassy and relay stories that we hear firsthand from people organizing in El Salvador and relay these stories to the embassy, the State Department, you know, in any way we can. Another thing we did that year when it was a May Day delegation was to participate in the May Day parade, which was really amazing. There were hundreds of thousands of people in the street, like 800,000 people in the street. And another thing we did was go to the International Law Enforcement Academy building that is this. There's six or seven of these around the world. El Salvador just opened up another one at the behest of Condoleezza Rice, and they train Latin American police forces from like basically every country except for Cuba and Venezuela. And I'm sure they're going to start taking more off their list. So yes, to go down and to experience what's happening in El Salvador so we can come back and talk to people in the United States about what we witnessed and who we met and why what's happening in El Salvador is a good example of how we can be organizing in the United States.
Okay, that's a lot of stuff. Well, I guess we'll talk about that most recent thing you just said, which is... Can you say it again? Why what's happening in El Salvador we should be organizing like in the United States?
Yeah, well...
You mean adopting models that are successful there and using them here?
I guess that if you find a model you want to adopt it, then out of something you witness or hear from someone coming back from El Salvador, I'd say do it. But I would say more as like an inspirational kind of piece and to see how unions work and how they stay strong and how they keep their base. Or student groups and how they choose to organize on their campus. So not necessarily like cookie cutter like adopting models, but just one to know that, you know, there's a lot of organizing happening elsewhere around the world, particularly in El Salvador, we can speak to, and then to know that, you know, it's the same struggle, you know, they're fighting for their self-determination, and, you know, we're organizing here. Well, I can't speak to you, but...
It's funny. That's interesting. that makes me think of another question, which is like trying to adopt models from elsewhere, because maybe you can talk about the... I feel like I was in El Salvador. I don't feel like I was. I was there before. And the political climate there is a lot different, and like the consciousness of people and like the ethnoland there is like fucking enormous. And El Salvador is also a really small country.
True.
But I was there for May Day last year. Maybe you could talk about just the kind of atmosphere that you experienced there in general, and then like May Day specifically. I think it's hard for people with don't have context or like haven't seen it to understand. Like, I feel like it's a lot different there, the feeling of like awareness and like how more immediate like political things are there, especially from like the Civil War and like having like a left-leaning government in power and like all these other factors, I think lead to like just kind of different feeling of, I don't know, possibility and like our immediacy or something, you know, getting that. Because like in our May Days, like things are different.
Quite different, yes. Let me think. So I think one thing that speaks to the difference of organizing and level of consciousness and even just the words that are thrown around, I mean, you could just begin to touch superficially on a political conversation with someone, and I'm assuming this is in Latin America in general, because I've heard this also in Mexico and Guatemala, but you just begin to start talking about politics, and instantly people are talking about neoliberalism. Instantly people are talking neocolonialism. Recently, people are talking about the IMF and the World Bank and all these things that people pay good money to go to school and learn about here in the United States. Our common ideas are talked about all the time, and I think that lends to the fact that, well, they're subject, you know, they're experiencing the effects of such institutions and of such economic models firsthand, whereas we have to travel or study or pay to learn about these models, which I guess is, or, you know, go out of our way to try to find this information, to access it, to understand it, because we are not subjugated to such. I think that brings the level of consciousness and the amount of organizing and the immediacy of organizing, you know, right to the front of the issue. But May Day in El Salvador was something amazing. It was absolutely awe-inspiring. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of people in the street. There were hundreds of different organizations represented. This march went on for hours and hours and hours and snaked around San Salvador, I don't know how many different times. And
San Salvador's capital?
San Salvador is the capital of El Salvador. It's a pretty big city. It has about half of the country's population in it. And El Salvador is about the size of Massachusetts. So that is, you brought that up just a second ago, and that is another huge factor about it. If we were organizing a nation that was the size of Massachusetts, it would be a little bit easier. Things would be a little more personable and familiar, but being down there on May Day was amazing. The amount of enthusiasm, the amount of planning, the amount of everything that went into May Day, I mean, it's not like here, at least in my experience, is trying to get together with people for organizing around May Day. Usually ends up happening in the last minute. We can never really mobilize I've never seen more than 100 people out for May Day. And it's pretty, it's interesting because it's a holiday that was born in, Chicago. Was born in the United States, and is actually celebrated more around the world than it is in the United States, which is another point to what you're talking about and the differences of what's happening is just how depoliticized people are in the United States, how there's been a systemic dumbing down of people in the United States, and well, that's our task, I guess, organizing here, but yeah, sorry, I just lost my train of thought.
That's okay, because I wanted to correct you about something, which is that May Day in Olympia, I think, maybe in the past couple years, has seen a different face. But historically, and by historically I mean since 2000 and till 2009, has seen lots of different manifestations and, like, there has been lots of organizing, like, many, many months prior to May Day before in the past, and there has been, like, a great deal of, like, people in the streets, hundreds, 300s before, and that has seemed like kind of like a broader level of support than it has maybe more recently, which is, you know, debatable amongst Olympians why that has happened, but,
My experience of Olympia May Days has been in the last 3 years, okay.
And the other thing I wanted to say was about when we're talking about we and our exposure to the ramifications of, like, political decisions that are, like, detached from us,
yeah.
Is, like, we are would be different than sectors in the United States who I feel probably have a more similar confrontation with those political ramifications with the people poor people in El Salvador or people in El Salvador in general, because, like, those ramifications I think hit people in the United States also just as hard, but like when I say we, I'm not usually talking about, like, really heavily impoverished sectors of the population which exist within our borders too.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's a very good point to bring up. So I guess the frequency or the amount of people in El Salvador affected by these policies, I guess, is higher than in my experience in the U.S. But definitely, yeah, not to minimize or invisibilize the experiences of people who know neoliberalism, who know all that fun shit that affects all of our lives so wonderfully.
Back to this CISBIS Olympia, maybe you want to talk about some other way, some ways that y'all raise awareness?
Well, we try to show movies on campus. We try to have events as often as we can, and bringing in, you know, a Latin American analysis, or at least an analysis of, having the focal point be on Latin America in general. I would say, yeah, we focus mainly on the campus right now, which is why there's a push to get out into the community and begin being much more purposeful, I guess, for lack of a better word, and bringing more events and having more discussions and having this be more a presence in Olympia. And there are a lot of people doing other things also, but I guess CISBIS, we focus right now, only CISBIS has been focusing on campus, and, you know, we've been showing movies, having discussions, printing off lots of material, passing it out, trying to get people to be talking and aware of what's happening. Other than that, pretty trying to bring people to El Salvador, what have you.
Great. I'm going to honor the caller's request for sex vid, and then maybe we'll get back and then wrap things up, maybe talk about how people can get plugged in with CISBIS, or like what's in the future here in Olympia. Gabba gabba hey, it's 4:48, Free Radio Olympia. Thank you, caller. I hope this is what you're looking for. It's all that I could find on the computer. Good afternoon, you're listening to Free Radio Olympia, 98.5 FM. It's 5 minutes to 5 o'clock. We're broadcasting at 100 watts. And we don't have a license to do it. Number in the studio is 705-9780. Please call and participate with us. And we're talking to Bunny Face about Latin American solidarity. We've covered such topics as May Day and FMLN, and now we're going to clue you in on getting involved with CISPIS if you'd like to, and maybe some upcoming projects that CISPIS is bringing to your doorstep from El Salvador.
Great. Well, CISPIS, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, Olympia chapter, has a few things coming up. I don't know if you've heard, but the FMLN just won the presidential elections and has become the first political force in El Salvador, and we had 3 people from Olympia down there this last March 15th on a delegation of 66, or rather 65 U.S. citizens and 1 Australian. And so coming to Olympia in the next couple of weeks will be a series of report backs talking about what we saw in El Salvador with CISPIS. But then following that and using momentum from this amazing change that just happened in Latin America, we will be working on a Latin American Solidarity Center, which you can get plugged into by checking us out. Well, if you want to get involved with CISPIS and Olympia, or if you want to get involved with any other projects we're working on that you can be talked about in the next few seconds, you can email us at olicispes, and that's C-I-S-P-E-S, at gmail.com. But after we do a few report backs, which will be happening on campus and as well as in the community, we don't have our dates yet lined up yet, but we'll get them to you as soon as we can. There's also going to be a solidarity cycle happening in the last week of June, where some cats in Seattle CISPIS, is going to be biking down to Tacoma. We're trying to rally some kids to want to bike up to Tacoma and meet them, possibly stage a demonstration at the detention center, hang out at the Catholic worker house there. Also, what am I missing? We're going to be having a possible victory tour happening in June, coming around. But definitely check out our report backs. You can get a hold of us at olicispis@gmail.com. I guess that's all for now.
Do you have any more to talk about that Latin American Solidarity Center?
Well, no, not really. It hasn't. Well, it's been an idea that's been in the works for a minute. We've been trying to get, we have some space at Media Island. And we're going to be using that space, and we're having a meeting this week to see how we want that to look, or who we can find, who wants to put energy into getting this thing off the ground and creating a spot in Olympia where people can get plugged into any number of groups that deal in Latin America, Latin American Solidarity, or what have you, and get plugged in and get organized and raise people's awareness of what's going on. So right now there's not really much concrete I can give you other than it should be happening, so keep yourself open to it.
Okay, that before we go, maybe I will ask you this about in relation to the Northwest Detention Center, which is in the Tidal Flats in Tacoma, where they put illegal aliens. Is there a big population of El Salvadorians in the United States? And what's that relationship like? Can you say about that?
Between CISPIS and Salvadorans in the U.S.
Or CISPIS and like
immigration?
I feel like when I was in Guatemala, in Mexico, I was always hearing about how like a huge amount of the population was in the United States.
Of El Salvadoran population or Guatemalan population?
Both.
Yeah, there is a huge amount of Salvadorans in the United States, and in Canada, but there are a huge amount in L.A. probably the biggest. BC has a huge population. It's a little, there's a handful of folks, not, I shouldn't say handful, there's a community up in Seattle. There are families around this area as well that, you know, I don't have any numbers. I know it's huge. It's something bigger than you would even imagine, like 3 or 4 million people in the country. I think 3 million people, Salvadorans, live outside of the borders of El Salvador.
What's the total population of El Salvador?
I want to say 6.
Yeah. That's crazy.
So you have like a third of Salvadorans, a third of the country is out and around. And you imagine, I mean, I would imagine. There's a handful of them in Sweden too, which is interesting to hear. Canada, huge portion of the United States. And yes, they too are criminalized and housed in these bullshit for-profit prisons.
Thinking of that, it's crazy to think that what kind of like, how half of a population of a country can be moved somewhere else. And it makes you wonder why that would happen. And something that has to do with that in large part is NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And this Friday at 7, or okay, great. That's very helpful. This Friday, that's April 10th at 7 o'clock at St. John's Episcopal Church on 19th Avenue and Capitol Way. Their Witness for Peace Northwest Speaker Tour is going to be celebrating the 15th birthday of NAFTA and talk about free trade, food security, and migration in Mexico. Take a deeper look at the effects of NAFTA, including resistance to genetically modified corn, the impact of migration on sending communities, and the struggle for food security in Oaxaca's indigenous communities. Yeah. So check that out. Fill in some holes and answer some questions. And the last thing I have, and then I'll give you a last word, is what has the relationship with the FMLN and the Obama administration looked like thus far? Like, have they said anything specifically about the FMLN winning?
Yeah, I mean, it was, before, up until about a week or less before the elections, there wasn't much being said, and it was kind of weird, because the U.S. has this history of coming out with these ridiculous statements about what would happen if an FMLN government did indeed win. In fact, 2004, we have the U.S. ambassador of El Salvador admitting that the U.S. intervened in the 2004 elections because of threatening the temporary protectionary status of Salvadorans in the United States and the cutting off of remittances, that is money sent back to El Salvador from the United States. And so what was interesting is this time is that happened again, actually. Some people on the House floor came out and said these things that were totally lies. And there was all this huge mobilization from people in El Salvador and people in the United States. And the Obama administration did eventually come out and say that they would respect the democratic results of the elections that happened on March 15th. And so far, I've kind of held true to their word. I mean, I don't really know how to go about, like, checking up on that. Biden, our Vice President Joseph Biden, is going to be meeting with Funes. Mauricio Funes is the president of El Salvador now. They're going to be meeting, I think, this week. Right after the election, Thomas Shannon, who's part of the State Department, went and congratulated. So there's been this, like, air of happiness in the U.S., in the Obama administration so far, because, and this is fucking disgusting, they're almost justifying their military actions in El Salvador in the 1980s by the FMLN victory by saying, this is the end result that we were hoping for to have it in El Salvador. This justifies all of our military, you know, intervention and blah, 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 and it's just total bullshit. But, yeah, from the administration so far, nothing really, you know, they've sent congratulatory things, and you can only imagine that they're going to try to pull Funes further away from the party and try to Lulaize him or centricize him and take him away from them. From the party, which is heavily left, but that's my understanding. I haven't really been researching.
I haven't been either. Sounds like typical Obama treatment of things, which is like hot air.
Yeah.
And like, this is going to be so awesome because I'm Obama, and then like nothing happens, and if it does, it's like not what people were expecting.
Right.
So, what the fuck?
I don't know. But people are worried about that happening in El Salvador with Funes as well, because, I mean, a lot of comparison is brought from the Obama campaign and the Funes campaign. It's like the hope, the change, the, you know, I mean, the historic ramification of the elections, you know, there's a lot of that being drawn, but I at least hope Funes has a little more wherewithal not to fucking be another goddamn politician.
Goddamn politicians. Any last words?
Yeah, get involved with Oli Cispas. You can also get us on Facebook or Oli Cispas. You should connect with us, shoot us your email, contact us somehow if you can with email. I guess that's our only way of contacting us at this moment. You should do it. You should get involved. If El Salvador isn't your passion, but Latin America is, get involved. We'll put you in the right direction. Get involved. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Bunny Face.
Get involved with something.
Message of the day is to do something. With yourself, besides touching it. You're listening to Free Radio Olympia 98.5. We're going to take a brief comedy break.
All right.
Steven, it's Mom. Give me a call. I'm still your mother, you know.
I'm getting on. Steven, call your mother.
Hey, Steven, just checking in. Give me a ring. I'm at 555-4329.
What's up, Steve? I'm at a payphone. If you're there, pick up. Pick up, 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 pick up.
Okay, I'll be home later. Okay, I'm home. Give me a buzz when you get in. I'll be here pretty much all night. Hey, man, it's me again. I was just taking a whiz. Thought you might have called. Okay, later.
We're having ourselves quite a little game of phone tag here. I was just blow drying my hair. Thought I heard the phone ring. Did that ever happen to you? Anyway, call me. We'll talk about it.
Steven, I think your machine is... Oh, shit.
Dead mood. We'll be right back. Dead air.
Dead air.
Dead moon.
It's okay. We all seen better days. It's okay. You don't have to run and hide away. It's okay. It's okay. Yeah, we love you anyway. All those reckless moments when that is creeping in your head. Feeling like you lost your youth in the dreams you had, cold and dead. I can't reach you anymore. It's gonna take a different man. I can't protect you like before. Just slip beyond my hand. But it's okay.
It's okay.
We all seen better days. It's okay.
It's okay.
You don't have to run and hide away. It's okay.
Hey, it's okay.
Okay, okay, okay. It's okay. I wish that I could light the path that leads to a life of no mistakes. Hold you from the den, be done, the living out of safety seems to take. I remember still the child in you, as if only yesterday. It was easy to break through, only had to kiss the pain. And it's okay,
hey, it's okay.
We all seen better days.
My choice, this is my voice. There may be no tomorrow. This is my plea, this is my need. This is my time for standing free. This is my step, this is my death. In a world demanded of me.
It's okay.
No. Thanks for listening. That's Dead Moon. This is a Something to Dance To show. Mic 1, Mic 2 are on because there's two of us in here. I'm DJ Lisp, joined now by a different person than who was just on. We switched completely channels, seats, and fingerprints. And so now here is Bunnyface, welcome to the studio.
Yes.
It's 5:14. We're still Something to Dance Toing. I had on the agenda to play some music and also to talk about sex. But more specifically to talk about... I'm going to play that song. If you have a song that sings about patriarchy, 705-9780. But I was gonna. There's this article that I've read before that's interesting that is quoted in Bell Hooks' book, "The Will to Change," Men, Masculinity, and Love, which it talks about patriarchy and its ill effects on everyone. Men and women and all gender types that exist in this culture, and how it gives us all a bad time and makes us all pretty damaged to different extents as far as our identity and having a tool set that involves or includes healthy forms of communicating and honesty and all that kind of shit that is pretty prevalent in our lives. Because I know for myself, having a conversation with a very great person last night, that patriarchy, or like living in a male-dominated society, can really be suffocating for men. I'm just gonna talk about men because, as a male-identified person, that's what I can speak to on a personal level. But you know, growing up, and this is probably nothing new, but something that I think that constantly needs to be talked about and dealt with, is that growing up and having learned behaviors being individualistic and stoic and strong and, like, you know, not being vulnerable ever, like, I guess is really helpful in some points if you're, like, trying to, like, ignore things and put them away and not deal with shit ever. But I feel like in the long run, many times it comes around and it really kind of fucks you up when you're trying to build relationships that have anything to do with, like, honesty and, like, getting to know each other on a genuine level. So that's something that I think a lot about, and probably lots of other men do, whether they know it or not. But I was going to read about this guy, Robert Jensen, from a book, and the chapter is called Patriarchal Sex. Unless you wanted to say something funny relating to that topic. That is not the song I was going to put on, by the way.
No, I know. Yeah, relating to that subject. Yes. I don't have very great words to say about this. I guess I'm not versed or very well read in any of these ideas, although I do understand what you're saying, and I think a lot of men are becoming aware of that, and maybe we should also think about, I mean, I know this has been happening in Olympia for a little while now, but men's groups sprouting up and talking about exactly this and patriarchy affecting men and how to deal with that healthily and how to not take that out on everyone around you, and learning how to deal with the socialized male and how to shred that in a good, healthy way. I don't know. I mean, it's a lot. I don't know. I deal with it. I try to talk about it. I don't know how good I am at it. But, yeah.
Practice, practice, practice.
True.
But I would say that, I mean, most of us probably haven't read a lot about it, but, like, what's a bigger influence on, like, your understanding of that stuff is, like, the fact that you, like, as men, that you are a man and you have been raised that way, and, like, that some people treat you, and those are, like, the benefits that you've gotten, and also, like, those are the drawbacks that you begin to see as you, like, if you're interested in, like, taking that veil away, and, like, how that has, like, disassociated yourself with other people, and, like, really, for me, I feel like not allowed for the full extent and the full, like, greatness that is possible between two people. Like, my relationships with, like, my dad are pretty, like, are improving and are better, and, like, but they're still pretty poor, you know? Like, there's not a great level of, like, communicating about, like, emotional stuff and, like, really just basic sharing of, like, what's happening in our lives that isn't, like, fucking, how about that tennis match and shit? Or like, you should get health insurance, because that's important. Brush and floss your teeth every day and whatever. And like, with my brother, with my mom, with like, partners, I think all of those relationships suffer because of like ingrained behaviors that I have of like building walls and like not letting my like the full part of me out, which is like, on one hand, like I feel like I'm just ill-equipped to do that. Like even if I, when I think about it and I know that I need to do that, I still have a hard time just figuring out how to begin because it's such a foreign thing. But what I think that I realize is that like, it's one thing to like name a problem and like be aware of it and then like recognize all these instances where like it's like fucked you and it's like created like these toxic or like really limiting experiences, and then it's another to be like, this is what I'm going to actively do about it, which seems like, you know, real logical. It's like what we would do in other situations, and like especially like in activist things, it's like, here, look at this country that's been like really fucked up by like colonialism and like later on down the line by like U.S. foreign policy, and like, and naturally what we're going to do about it is like come up with some goals and like some concrete steps to take forward and to do about that. But like it feels a lot different to like try to apply that to yourself on the interpersonal level.
Yeah, well, I think that you're right, it definitely feels a lot different to think about that and to try to understand that when we're talking about such things. But I think maybe the same approach could be had, where, you know, you identify the problem, you know, and you sit down and you think about it, and it makes you all angry or upset or sad and hurt and frustrated because it, you realize how much it's limited you in developing your full potential as a human being, right? And then the only thing to do is to try to take a step forward, and trying something in the beginning is better than just continuing to talk about it, but, you know, trying something, at least. And, you know, the first choice is you're not going to be right, and you're probably going to fail and have to, you know, humble yourself and be, you know, have humility and be able to be like, yeah, okay, but I'm trying, so maybe the first thing won't be right. So it's like you're setting yourself up for a lot of failure and a lot of, like, open wounds and a lot of, like, displaying your you know, your humility to the world, but I think that's also part of it, you know?
What was I going to say? Oh, I also think it's funny that, just thinking about what I just said, that it's, like, pretty... it sounds like a really typical male approach to the problem. It's like what I just said is like, well, logically, what you should do is like take this and this and this step, which seems like, I don't know, more of the same kind of.
Yeah.
Which is funny, like how often like I just repeat like the same behavior of like, we could do this and this and this and set goals and blah blah blah, and like I don't think that's like really the point of a lot of time. Like, once I used to meet with this person who was really amazing and experienced, and I was expecting a lot from like our conversations, and like talking to this person was really great and like insightful, and I would just like talk, like have a basic conversation, but the, like, I mean, being like an expert that the person is, like her feedback or like the way of just like talking to me was really helpful. But then I was like riding my bike away from there, and I was like, well, wait a second, I didn't solve anything, or I didn't like, what am I supposed to do now? Or like, there was no steps. And then I was like, well, maybe that isn't necessarily what needs to be happening. What needs to be happening is just like initiating this process of like learning how to speak and how to talk and how to like act in a more or the less patriarchal manner.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely not going to be a quick fix, right? I mean, there's not going to be this, like, waving of a wand, and all of a sudden, you know, things are going to be drastically different. I mean, it's taken, I don't know, I can't speak to your age, but, you know, it's been around for a while, almost 3 decades.
16.
That's been a lot of time, and that's a lot of things that are stored in my brain, whether it's conscious or subconscious. So, I mean, who knows? I mean, you just, the point is to start the process and to not let it stop, right? So, and not every step along the way is going to be a concrete goal, which, like you brought up, is such a typically male idea of having this, like, concrete, solid, logic-based, very defined, somewhat sterile kind of thing.
Here's something that I think of a lot is that when people who are like activists or like politically conscious or like whatever are talking about things, they like are myself included, are we talk about things in like kind of like an ambiguous way with like these words that like are understood in certain circles but aren't elsewhere, and so like I can be talking about how lame patriarchy is and how like repressed my emotions are and stuff, but it doesn't really like resonate as much. Like those words can be just empty sometimes. So I think it's important to be like sharing actual stories and examples and like speaking about those things, whether or not like, I mean, not just to be like, here's this problem, let's solve it, or like, let's do, like, I just think it's important to like speak it and like share it and like not have the purpose of that being to like analyze it or whatever, but just like I think it's a healthy process to just be like telling those stories. Not that I'm advocating doing that right now, because I don't really have any.
I haven't prepared anything
off the top of my head, except for I guess I could talk about it kind of generally of like feedback that I've gotten from previous partners of like my behavior in those relationships typically being like controlling and like self-serving and like not always like complete like respectful on like an equal basis, and like I mean I guess that's kind of vague too, but like yeah, maybe I don't have a personal story yet.
Yeah. I can definitely recount times when I've been emotionally unavailable because of my own constructed walls, or I don't know how you want to perceive this thing. But yeah, definitely have. Why don't we hear from your, why don't we read a little bit of your excerpt? Maybe that'll get our minds working.
Well, I was thinking I'd play a Salt and Pepper song and then we'd read it.
Sounds like a great idea.
So that might throw off the vibe, which would probably be good. Since it is called Something to Dance to, Shizzo!
Spinderella cut it up one time. Or even mess with the press she says was next on her list. And believe me, you, it's
true. There ain't a man alive that she couldn't get next to. She had it all in the bag, so she should have been glad. But she was mad and sad and feeling bad, thinking about the things that she never had. No love, just sex, bottlenecks with a check and a note. That last night was dope, dope, dope.
Take it easy.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex.
Come on.
Let's talk about sex.
Gonna play this on the radio.
And why not? Everybody have sex.
I mean, everybody should be making love.
Come on, how many guys you know make
Let's
love?
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex.
Dead Moon with Let's Talk About Sex. You want to use that one? We'll switch when we're reading.
Yeah,
I'm going to read from Robert Jensen, Chapter 6, Patriarchal Sex. Patriarchal Sex, Example 1. Four male undergraduates at Cornell University post on the internet the top 75 reasons why women, bitches, should not have freedom of speech. Reason number 20. This is my dick. I'm gonna fuck you. No more stupid questions. Patriarchal sex example 2. Rhonda was separated from her husband, but was on generally friendly terms with him. One night he entered her home. For the next 7 hours, he raped her. It was like something just snapped in him. He grabbed me and said, "We gonna have sex. I need to fuck." I began with a working definition of patriarchal sex. Sex is fucking. In patriarchy, there is an imperative to fuck, in rape and in normal sex, with strangers and girlfriends and wives and estranged wives and children. What matters in patriarchal sex is a male need to fuck. When that need presents itself, sex occurs. From that, a working definition of what it means to be a man in this culture. A man is a male. A man is a male human who fucks. That is the next section, what I'm trying to do and what I'm not trying to do. In this essay, I want to analyze patriarchal sex and theorize about strategies for moving away from it. In simple terms, I want to think about how we males might stop fucking and stop being men. I draw on the work of radical feminist theorists and activists, my research on pornography and sexuality, and my experience as a man in the United States, in U.S. culture in the last half of the 20th century. I move without apology between personal narrative and reflection and more formal scholarly writing. I reject the conventional academic obsession with splitting off mind and body, reason and emotion, objective and subjective, scholarship and activism. One of the ways I know about the world is by living in it, and the knowledge I have gained has led me to a political position that makes certain actions on my part morally necessary. Decades of feminist and other critical work more than adequately justify this kind of engaged scholarship. What follows is part of my long-term project of trying to make sense of a system into which I was born, a system that privileges certain people with certain attributes, for example, white, male, heterosexual, educated, all of which I am or have been at one point in my life, and works to maintain the concentration of power in the hands of a relatively small group of people. This essay is not a men's studies or gender studies project. It is a feminist-inspired project. I am a man working within feminist theory to try to understand the nature of oppression, specifically in this essay, the nature of gender oppression and the role of sexuality in that oppression. My goal is to be a traitor to my gender, as well as to my race and my class. I routinely fail at this goal, though sometimes I get glimpses of what success looks like. I am fortunate to have had the support of many feminist women and a few like-minded male colleagues. Integral to that support is their willingness to hold me accountable for my actions and words. The critique is a key part of the support. Also, this essay is not an attempt to tell women what they should think or how they should behave. I am trying to talk primarily to other men about my struggle and what I have learned from it. I do this work both out of a yearning for justice for those oppressed in patriarchy, women, particularly lesbians, children, and to some extent gay men, and out of self-interest, the desire to live in a more fulfilling life in a more just, humane, and compassionate world. I work both out of hope for the future and out of fear. This is the fear.
The fear. What's your problem? Are you afraid of sex? That question has been posed to me often as I have been involved in anti-pornography work. For a long time, my answer was no, of course not. Me, afraid? I'm no prude. I am not a prude, but I have come to realize that I am very much afraid of sex. I'm afraid of sex as sex is defined by the dominant culture, practiced all around me and projected into magazine pages, billboards, and movie screens. I'm afraid of sex because I'm afraid of domination, cruelty, violence, and death. I'm afraid of sex because sex has hurt me in the past. I know that there are people out there who have been hurt by sex in ways that are beyond my words, who have experienced a depth of pain that I will never fully understand. And I know there are people who are dead because of sex. Yes, I am afraid of sex. How could I not be? A common response from people when I say things like that is, "You're nuts." Sometimes when I'm feeling shaky, a voice in the back of my head asks, "Am I nuts?" I've been doing research and writing on pornography and sexuality for about 8 years. In the past few years, I have been trying to figure out how to talk to people who think I am crazy and how to deal with my own fear that they may be right. I've been trying to understand why the attack on feminist critique of patriarchal sex has been so strong and so successful, and how it connects to the backlash against feminist work on sexual violence. Here's one tentative explanation. It is too scary to be afraid of sex. To go too far down the road with a radical critique of sexuality means, inevitably, acknowledging a fear of patriarchal sex. And if all the sex around us is patriarchal, then we are going to live daily with that fear. And if patriarchal sex seems to be so overwhelmingly dominant that it sometimes is difficult to believe that any other sex is possible, then maybe we are always going to be afraid. Maybe it's easier to not be afraid, or at least to repress the fear. Maybe that's the only way to survive. But maybe not. Maybe being afraid of sex is the first step towards something new. Maybe things that seem impossible now will be possible someday. Or maybe we will find that we won't need what we thought we needed. Maybe being afraid is the first step out of the fear and into something else that we cannot yet name.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Expanding the working definition of patriarchal sex. I was born in 1958 in a small city in the upper Midwest to white parents who, after some years of struggle, settled into the middle class. I went to a Protestant church and public school. I had friends, mostly other boys. We talked about sex and we begged, borrowed, and stole pornography. I watched a lot of television and went to a lot of movies. I had a G.I. Joe doll and toy guns. I played sports. I was a quirky kid in some respects, physically smaller than most, and a bit of an egghead from an early age. Maybe my family was a little more emotionally abusive than most, but maybe not. In many regards, I grew up normal, and I got a normal education in sex. Here's a curriculum for sex for a normal American boy. Fuck women. Here's a sexual grammar lesson I received. Man fucks women, subject, verb, object. The specifics varied depending on the instructor. Some people said, fuck as many women as often as you can, for as long as you can, get away with it. Others said, fuck a lot of women until you get tired of it, and then find one to marry and just fuck her. And some said, don't fuck any woman until you find one to marry, and then fuck her for the rest of your life, and never fuck anyone else. Some said, women are special. Put them on a pedestal before and after you fuck them. Others said, women are shit. Do what you have to do to fuck them, and then get away from them. Most said, only fuck women. A few said, fuck other men, if you want to. The basic concepts were clear. Sex is fucking. Fucking is penetration. The things you do before you penetrate are just warm-up exercises. If you don't penetrate, you haven't fucked. And if you haven't fucked, you haven't had sex. Fry defines this kind of heterosexual and heterosexist intercourse as male-dominant, female-subordinate copulation, whose completion and purpose is a male's ejaculation. That is sex and patriarchy. All the teachers, parents, friends, ministers, celebrities, pornographers, movie directors, etc., tend to agree on the one primary rule about sex and patriarchy. You gotta get it. You have to fuck something at some point in your life. If you don't get it, there's something wrong with you. You aren't normal. You aren't really alive. You certainly aren't a man. When I was a kid, I'm not sure I really wanted to fuck anyone, but eventually I figured out that if I didn't learn to do it, I was going to be an outcast. So I learned, though later than most of my peers. My first sex was with pornography. I was about 6 years old the first time I saw it. For the next 2 decades, it was part of my life on an irregular basis. I had sex with women in person, and I had sex with women in magazines and movies. Masturbating to pornography is a way of having sex, of sexually using the woman in it. As far as I can tell from research and conversations with men, I had a fairly typical sex life. I learned to like being in control. That was part of the appeal of sex with pornography. I had control over when I used it, and I was in control of the woman in it. That was part of the appeal of sex with women. I was a man, and I was in control because men, naturally, take control of sex. Once the details of access with a particular woman were negotiated, I was in control. Patriarchal sex practices vary from person to person, from attempts at a more egalitarian interaction to the sadomasochist. My preferred practices, on the surface, leaned more toward the egalitarian, but when I think about my sexual history, I can connect every practice to a need for control, either of the woman or of the woman's pleasure. When I started to realize that, I realized that I was in trouble. When I realized that most everyone around me was in trouble, I started to get scared. When I got really scared, I stopped having patriarchal sex. That meant I stopped having sex with other people, including the people in pornography. At first, I didn't do this consciously. I just found it more and more difficult to have sex. At some point, I consciously made a decision to quit. As I began to understand more about how deeply I had been trained in the rules of patriarchal sex, it became more clear that I would have to stop participating in that system. I would have to stop fucking. I could no longer pretend that I was working it out by trying to put into practice new ideas about sex. Patriarchal sex was too deeply rooted in my body and my psyche. Before I could reconstruct my sexuality, I needed time to deconstruct, free of the pressure to have sex.
Cool. The Radical Feminist Critique. By the time I came to understand that I wanted and needed to stop having patriarchal sex, I had a framework within which to understand what was happening to me. Radical feminist critiques of pornography and patriarchal sex gave me a vocabulary, a way to make coherent in words what was happening in my body and my mind. That made it possible, though by no means easy, to begin the process. Many feminist activists and the theorists have contributed to this critique. Here is my summary. Men in contemporary American culture, I make no claim to cross-culture or historical critique, I am writing about the world in which I live, are trained through a variety of cultural institutions to view sex as the acquisition of pleasure by taking of women. Sex is a sphere in which men, by this I don't mean that every man believes this, but that many men believe this is true for all men, believes themselves to be naturally dominant and the woman naturally passive. Women are objectified and women's sexuality is commodified. Sex is sexy because men are dominant and women are subordinate. Power is eroticized. In certain limited situations, those roles can be reversed. Men can play at being sexually subordinate and women dominant, so long as the power remains sexualized and the power relation outside the bedroom are unchanged. Summed up by Andrea Dworkin, the normal fuck by a normal man is taken to be an act of invasion, an ownership undertaken in a mode of predation, colonizing, forceful, manly, or nearly violent, the sexual act that, by its nature, makes her his. One of the key sites in which these sexual values are reflected, reinforced, and normalized is pornography.
Domination and subordination are sexualized, sometimes in explicit representations of rape and violence against women, but always in the objectification and commodification of women and their sexuality. This results in several kinds of harm to women and children. The harm caused in the production of pornography, the harm in having pornography forced on them, the harm in being sexually assaulted by men who use pornography, and the harm in living in a culture in which pornography reinforces and sexualizes women's subordinate status. In a world in which men hold most of the social, economic, political power, the result of patriarchal sexual system is widespread violence, sexualized violence, and violence by sex against women and children. This includes physical assault, emotional abuse, and rape by family members and acquaintances as well as strangers. Along with the experience of violence, women and children live with the knowledge that they are always targets. Attention to the meaning of the central male slang term for sexual intercourse, fuck, is instructive. To fuck a woman is to have sex with her. To fuck someone in another contest, text, such as, he really fucked me over on that deal, means to hurt or cheat a person. And when hurled as a simple insult, fuck you, the intent is denigration, and the remark is often prelude to violence or the threat of violence. Sex in the patriarchy is fucking, that we live in a world in which people continue to use the same word for sex and violence, and then resist the notion that sex is routinely violent and claim to be outraged when sex becomes overtly violent, is testament to the power of patriarchy. In this society, sex and violence are fused to the point of being indistinguishable. Yet to say this out loud is to risk being labeled crazy. What's wrong with you? Are you afraid of sex? Are you nuts?
The wrong way is out of this problem. All women and most men I've met are against rape. That is, they are against those acts that law defines as rape. But most aren't against fucking, because fucking is sex, and how can you be against sex, which is seen as natural? This view is summed up in the phrase, rape is a crime of violence, not of sex. But rape is a crime of sex. To de-sex rape is to turn away from the possibility of understanding rape. This is not to say that men don't seek power over women through rape, and that the power isn't expressed violently. It is to acknowledge that men seek power over women through sex of all kinds, including rape. I think people, men and women, want to believe that rape is violence, not sex, because to acknowledge that rape is sex requires that we ask how it is that so many men can decide that rape is an acceptable way to get sex. Rape is not the result of the aberrant behavior of a limited number of pathological men, but is normal within the logic of the system. When sex is about power and control, and men are socially and typically Sex is about power and control, and men are socially and typically physically more powerful than women and children, then sexual violence is the inevitable outcome. As Dworkin argues, rape is no excess, no aberration, no accident, no mistake. It embodies sexuality as a culture defines it. This does not mean that every man is a rapist in legal terms. It means that we live in a society in which men, both legally designated rapist and non-rapist, are raised with rapist ethics. Raping is a particularly brutal kind of fucking, but the difference between deviant rape and normal fuck is often difficult to see. Timothy Beneke, looking at how metaphors frame sex as an expression of male power and conquest, concludes, "Every man who grows up in America and learns American English learns all too much to think like a rapist, to structure his experience of women and sex in terms of status, hostility, control, and dominance." So the conventional view is that rape can't be about sex, and has to be about violence. Because if it's about sex, then each of us has to ask how deeply into our bodies the norms of patriarchal sex have settled. Men have to ask about how sexy dominance is to them, and women have to ask how sexy submission is to them. And if we think too long about that, we face the question of why we're still having patriarchal sex. And if we face that question, we may have to consider the possibility of stopping. And if we aren't having sex, then we have to face a dominant culture's assumption that we aren't really alive because we aren't having sex.
Women aren't victims, some say, and radical feminism has tried to turn women into victims by focusing on the harms of patriarchal sex. This is a deceptively appealing rhetorical move. When members of one class, women, identify a way that members of another class, men, routinely hurt them, those who are hurt are told they are responsible for this injury because they identified it. If women would stop talking about these injuries, the logic seems to be, then the injuries would stop. This strategy seems popular with some women and lots of men lately. I understand why men take this stance. It relieves them of any obligation to evaluate their own behavior and be responsible. I understand why women don't want to see themselves as always at the risk of men's violence and sexual aggression. But saying you aren't at risk because you don't want to be at risk doesn't take the risk away. What does the word victim mean? Dworkin writes, "It's a true word. If you were raped, you were victimized. You damned well were. You were a victim. It doesn't mean that you are a victim in the metaphysical sense, in your state of being, as an intrinsic part of your essence and existence. It means somebody hurt you. They injured you. And if it happens to you systematically because you are born a woman, it means that you live in a political system that uses pain and humiliation to control and to hurt you. Understanding one's victimization is not the same as playing the victim. Acknowledging that women often are victimized is not an admission of weakness or a retreat from responsibility. Instead, it makes it possible organized and sustained resistance to the power that causes the injuries. By clearly identifying the victimizers, most always men, and the system within which the injury is ignored or trivialized, patriarchy, we make political change possible. We live in a world in which some people exercise their power in a way that hurts others. It has become popular to pretend that the injuries are the product of an overactive imagination of whiners. White people routinely tell non-white people that racism is not a big problem, and that if the non-whites would stop complaining, all would be fine. Rich people tell poor and working people that there is no such thing as class in the United States, and that if we all would just work hard together, everything would be fine. Straight people tell lesbian and gay people that if they would just stop making such a public nuisance of themselves, everyone would leave them alone and things would be fine. But things aren't fine. We live in racism. Poor and working people are being crushed by a cruel economic system. Heterosexism oppresses lesbian and gays, and men keep fucking women.
Okay, we're getting close to 6 o'clock, so maybe we'll cut it there. And I'll just say about the article that was written in 1994. Good year. 1998, sorry. Oh, okay. Also a good year. If you were from the class of 1998. So that might explain some of the language in there is maybe a little dated from 10 years ago. Maybe like lesbians and gays would include LGBTI and whatever. I mean, there might be some issues there, and I would say that some of it has to do with when it was written. But so that's from a kind of like a, I think it's an excerpt from a book. Yes. And the book is called Feminism Men, Reconstructing Gender Relations. That was from chapter 6 by Robert Jensen, called Patriarchal Sex, which I don't know where you can find that. You can write that guy and ask him for it. That's how I got it. And that's also, you can read The Will to Change by Bell Hooks, Men, Masculinity, and Love, which is a great book about similar things. So is the gender knot. Unraveling the gender knot, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to queue up Free Speech Radio News here momentarily. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Bunnyface 1 and Bunnyface 2. Cispus is alive and well in Olympia, so check that out. At olicispus at gmail.com. And stay tuned for next week. I guess that we'll wrap up. Well, we won't wrap it up, but we'll finish reading this piece about patriarchal sex. In the meantime, I'm going to fulfill the other part of my show, which is dancing with a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Thank you.
loot, them a shoot, them a whale.
Ashanti
Town. Them a loot, them a shoot, them a whale.
Ashanti Town.
Okay, thank you for listening to Sunday Dance 2 Show. It's just after 6 and it's time for Free Speech Radio News. Big one!
From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, April 6, 2009. The international community scrambles and fails to respond to North Korea's controversial rocket launch. We'll go to Houston, where high-power firearms sales may be contributing to violence on the border. And Obama's focus on Afghanistan gains some popular support in Europe, but will that translate into military aid? I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for those stories after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, the United States Supreme Court refused to grant Mumia Abu-Jamal a new trial. Abu-Jamal was convicted of killing a police officer in 1981. He claims that prosecutors wrongfully excluded potential black jurors based solely on their race, a claim referred to as the Batson claim. Abu-Jamal spoke from prison today. He says the court gave no indication of the basis on which they denied his appeal.
There's no order other than my name is on a list of cert denied. If it is the Batson issue, then it just shows you that precedent means nothing, that the law is politics by other means, and that the Constitution means nothing. That a fair jury means nothing.
The Third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia earlier ruled that Abu-Jamal's death sentence is invalid. Pennsylvania has petitioned the High Court to reinstate his death sentence. The court has yet to decide on that matter. The search for earthquake survivors in 26 towns and cities in Italy continued today. Diletta Varlese reports.
Thus far, about 100 people have